So, I just wanted to cover this controversial topic of nuclear weapons. There's been so much talk of this over the years with all these different war scenarios, fear porn and propaganda and everything else. I used to equate this with flat earth theory, which is like the term conspiracy theory that was created by the CIA to shut down free speech. This automatically makes anyone that you bring this up to have a knee-jerk reaction of, oh, you're crazy, man. You're into that conspiracy stuff. So just like the Bible, government media info for the gullible, brainwashed sheeple cannot be questioned. So this started with the Manhattan Project in the 40s. When they didn't even know what DNA was, they figured out how to split the atom somehow, I guess, with sacred cows like Oppenheimer, Einstein, Edward Teller, Enrico Fermi, and many others at Los Alamos Labs in New Mexico. I question this whole prospect because it seems to be all staffed by a certain tribe. I'm sure you know who I'm talking about. And all the footage of the early nuke tests seemed to be filmed with models. They were all filmed using models like old movies or stacks of tons of TNT on top of each other that gave a huge petroleum-based explosion. And then there were many films on television to create fear propaganda, like The Man Who Saw Tomorrow, The Day After. They're designed to create paranoia, dread, and a domesticated populace, kind of like the duck and cover drills in the 50s during the fake Cold War era. And I'd like to ask most laymen if they even understand how nuclear energy or nuclear weapons work or what radiation is. It's basically an expenditure of energy. A lot of things create radiation, much like radon testing. How dangerous can it be? And what determines this? So what they want you to believe is that with the push of a button, man has the power to destroy the earth. I think in reality, only God has that power. But these psychopath control freaks that are the oligarchs controlling our world right now want you to believe that their power has no bounds. These are some clips that I'm putting together, and the best of some of the videos I've seen. And they put out a good argument, so check it out. I usually don't touch upon these subjects on this channel, but this is something not a whole lot of people are getting into, and I feel like really needs to be brought to people's attention. A lot of subjects are being forbidden to be talking about on the platform of YouTube, and I just hear a lot of fear-mongering out there about nuclear war, certain countries having nuclear weapons, and all this paranoia and fear-mongering, and I really just wanted to touch upon that. So, hope you get something out of this.
Do nuclear bombs exist? Your immediate answer is yes. But how do you know? During the mid-20th century, television and movie watchers were bombarded with imagery of what was purported to be atomic test footage. But what were they really watching? They couldn't rewind a videotape or re-scan through a video on their computer. So what option did they have but to accept these images at their face value? Now we have opportunity to scrutinize these images to see if they hold up to analysis. Take a look at these trees. Well, what was that? And who turned the camera? They're in awfully straight lines, aren't they? Now this must be a different blast because it's coming from a different direction. Wait, now they've put it back. But those are the same trees we saw in the first clip, aren't they? And now this. First they showed us these trees that they panned left on. Then they show us these trees that look like they should be next to a model train. Notice how straight the rows are. It looks artificial to me. Then they show us these trees again. Where's the forward camera? And then back to these trees again. And then they show us what looks to be a real forest that's been chopped down or torn down. Now take a look at this. It's footage of the first H-bomb test called Ivy Mike. Watch how it changes. That's a composite. Then it morphs into this. It looks like a completely separate explosion. Now take a look at the frame before the explosion, and then the one after. These frames were cut together. Why? Then this frame was cut to this, which looks like the sun to me. It looks like they're zooming in on the sun. Maybe a composite because the clouds aren't moving. Then they introduce some sort of liquid. It looks like a laboratory concoction in composite with the sun. Next is Operation Dominic Fireballs in the Yukon. What does that look like to you? Watch it again. It's the sun. Now here's Operation Greenhouse. These guys are getting all ready to see what looks to be the sun again. The sun seems to start to expand. Maybe it's being zoomed in on. And who headed up the whole program? None other than J. Robert Oppenheimer of the Oppenheimer family, who is reputed to have been the original financiers who got the Rothschilds started in Frankfurt, Germany in the 18th century.
He should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds."
You're thinking, what about Hiroshima? Is that Hiroshima? Is that Hiroshima? That looks like Hiroshima, but it looks like it's been carpet bombed. Check out this image of Rotterdam. Was that a nuclear bomb? Now compare it to this image of Hiroshima. Actually, this isn't Hiroshima, it's Tokyo after firebombing in 1945. If you accept that FDR might have had foreknowledge of the bombing at Pearl Harbor, maybe you might want to leave room for the possibility that his propaganda machine might have created the myth of atomic bombs. There's no question that the powers that be have ballistics with tremendous explosive capacity. But this shot, for example, could easily be high-volume dynamite. And what are we looking at here? Take a look at this house again. Whatever was strong enough to blow it to smithereens wasn't strong enough to even shake the camera. And look how high up the camera position is. Are we looking at another model? Now look at this bus and this car. Whatever's blowing them up is not moving the camera. And this building seems to blow up from the inside. Everything gets blown every which way except for the camera. Except look in this shot, it seems to tilt up a little bit. Now this is one of my favorites. Watch the two guys behind the glass. Who's filming them? Isn't he being exposed to all that rocket fuel? Anyways, I'm not trying to convince anyone of anything. If you're hell-bent on believing that they can blow up the world at the push of a button, then go ahead. But next time you hear a politician justifying the invasion of a country based on the fact that they supposedly have weapons of mass destruction, realize that they're not only lying about the other country supposedly possessing weapons of mass destruction, they also may be lying about the very existence of weapons of mass destruction. And why don't they call them nuclear bombs anymore?
The military-industrial complex finds it convenient to perpetuate the myth of nuclear weapons to exploit the American people. Nuclear bombs do not exist. Think about it. Eisenhower warned the American citizens of the military-industrial complex. They have ransacked the people of trillions of dollars while the education system degenerates. Let's split down the middle two issues. First, Japan, then nuclear energy. In 1945, most of Japan's infrastructure was wood. The oldest wooden buildings in the world can be found in Japan, Nara. To erase Hiroshima and Nagasaki with firebombs was achievable. Is it unthinkable Japan was actually firebombed, and that's the reason for the time delay between each attack? In fact, the Great Fires of Chicago in 1871 took roughly the same amount of time, which leveled the entire wooden city. 3 days. Perhaps that's the reason why the Japanese started rebuilding immediately, regardless of the imagined radiation. As far as nuclear energy, why hasn't it replaced oil? It's a fishy story. People shrug off the reasons why this might be. What about nuclear testing? The military-industrial marketplace sneakily used high-tech dynamite and flash bombs dropped from high altitude. That's the reason for the mysterious white trails near nearly every so-called nuke test explosion. We haven't unloaded nuclear or atomic bombs in 70 years. Are we that rational? Or is the illusion of nuclear arms a way to cash in through taxation like the fake moon landings?
Do North Korea have nukes? Are the Iranians still trying to build a nuclear bomb? Are we perpetually on the brink of thermonuclear war? The governments and the elites that control them have such a history of lying to the public, can we not assume we are not being told the truth? From the Titanic to 9/11, the public have been fed one pantomime after another. Can we not be forgiven for questioning nuclear weapons, perhaps their tallest of tales? All this time has passed and still no nuclear war. This is excused with the notion of mutually assured destruction, the idea that all supposedly nuclear armed nations fear their own nuclear destruction too much to try to destroy another, and so we live in perpetual nuclear peace in a world of continuous conventional war. What if all war was a fraud, the banking elite controlling all sides, all playing for a draw, not trying to defeat their enemy, but controlling their populations with fear? Why not forget the weapons and simulate it all on computers?
It's a bluff, John Coilon. No, it's not a bluff, it's real.
Hello, General Barringer. Stephen Falcon.
Mr. Falcon, you picked a hell of a day for a visit.
General, what you see on these screens up here is a fantasy, a computer-enhanced hallucination. Those blips are not real missiles, they're phantoms.
Jack, there's nothing to indicate a simulation at all. Everything's working perfectly.
But But does it make any sense?
Does what make any sense?
Wouldn't it be cheaper and easier to pretend? Why spend all that money on weapons you know you're never going to use? When convincing your enemy or your public you've got them achieves the same ends. Want to endanger themselves with nuclear weapons considering what they can supposedly do? Do they want to destroy the world and hide underground in bunkers? Or is that just what they want you to think? They haven't done it yet, and I wouldn't hold your breath. Why have lots of nukes pointed at each other? Why not just have one very big one each, powerful enough to destroy the world? Would it not offer the same protection? If nuclear weapons exist, why do they tell us? Why aren't they kept secret? Surely it would be the best way to prevent them from proliferating. They are so secretive about all their other weapon systems, like HARP, directed energy weapons, rail guns and coil guns and rods of God or kinetic weapons. Real or not, nuclear weapons are weapons of propaganda, designed to fill the public with fear, through which the elites control the population of the world.
Is this a game or is it real? What's the difference?
German scientists had split the atom by bombarding uranium with neutrons, which caused instability in the uranium nucleus. During this split, mass was lost and was converted into kinetic energy. They had discovered fission, and with it, opened a Pandora's box.
If each of those neutrons goes into another uranium nucleus and causes fission, then the first fission has led to more than two fissions in the next generation, and you can see that each successive generation has many more neutrons, and this causes an explosive chain reaction.
If two masses of highly fissionable uranium in the form of a sphere and a plug could be brought together with sufficient speed inside a bomb, an exponentially increasing chain reaction with explosive force would result.
It was known that the nucleus of one form of uranium, isotope 235, would split when it absorbed a neutron. When this happened, energy was released and more neutrons were created that struck and split other nuclei. When it happens continuously, it's known as a chain reaction. No one knew at the start how much fissionable material was needed to support an explosive chain reaction. That volume would be known as the critical mass. Another element, only discovered in late 1941 by Berkeley nuclear chemist Glenn Seaborg, also had the properties to explode in a chain reaction.
And we immediately saw no one's mind was on anything, but how can this
be?
It's quite possible to make an explosion of this.
It was this concern that led refugee German physicist Leo Szilard to reveal that possibility to the U.S. government. Together with Albert Einstein and Edward Teller, he composed a letter to President Franklin Roosevelt. It told of a terrible possibility. Germany had the talent and the knowledge to research and develop an atomic weapon. Delivering the letter to Roosevelt on their behalf was economist Alexander Sachs, a friend of Szilard and economic advisor to the president.
Let's take a look at this letter. It may become possible to set up a nuclear chain reaction in a large mass of uranium. This new phenomenon would also lead to the construction of bombs, and it is conceivable, though much less certain, that extremely powerful bombs of a new type may thus be constructed. However, such bombs might very well prove to be too heavy for transportation by air.
Major General Leslie R. Groves, the man responsible for the Pentagon, was placed in charge of the project.
The project was massive. to design and build a device that existed only in theory from material that didn't exist in any quantity under unprecedented secrecy.
Bullshit.
This would also facilitate the hoax. The nuclear bomb hoax thrives on secrecy, and in fact, one of its main purposes is to create an apparent need for extreme secrecy within the government and the industrial military complex. One of the main purposes for the creation of the myth of nuclear weapons is the rise of the secret services.
To head up the installation, Groves, an expert judge of men, chose a most unlikely candidate, J. Robert Oppenheimer. A gifted physics professor, Oppenheimer had a reputation for being temperamental, perhaps not suited for a highly stressful assignment.
Groves advised that Oppenheimer would be a disaster. People told him that Oppenheimer couldn't run a hot dog stand.
Fundamentally, he seems to have had some of the qualities of an actor. He was different things to different people.
Oppenheimer drew luminaries like Enrico Fermi, Hans Bethe, and Edward Teller to the facility, as well as technicians fresh out of college. During the fall of 1942, the theoretical physicists at Los Alamos began the difficult process of trying to determine how much U-235 it would take to make a bomb. Robert Oppenheimer's team of physicists doubled the amount of uranium-235 thought necessary to achieve critical mass and sustain an explosive chain reaction to 200 kilograms. Their calculation, made without adequate samples of U-235 for tests, would prove to be 10 times the required amount.
It was important that the critical mass was not too small. That would make nuclear bombs too cheap and easy to make. But equally, it was important that the critical mass was not too large, as this would make deliverable bombs an impossibility.
The main obstacle was how to quickly assemble two smaller subcritical masses into one larger explosive one. The bomb design that they came up with was a gun design. Inside the bomb, a cannon would fire one piece of radioactive fuel into another at 3,000 feet per second. The pieces had to come together fast enough to prevent spontaneously emitted neutrons from melting the fuel, causing the bomb to fizzle rather than explode. On December 28, 1942, President Roosevelt approved an additional $500 million investment in the Manhattan Project. The first priority, to build the massive industrial facilities that would produce the fissionable material to fuel the atom bomb.
Though they wanted people to believe a nuclear explosion was possible, it was also important that not just anyone could do it, that it was not replicable without extreme cost. And so they would make the nuclear fuel as difficult to make as possible. There is also a huge profit motive for doing this. There are vast sums of money to be made from supposed nuclear fuel, from its production and from its protection, transportation and storage before and after use.
These gigantic structures contained multiple calutrons, box-shaped collection units that were configured in a racetrack layout. A magnetic field passed throughout the entire oval of calutrons, causing the divergence of streams of U-235 and U-238, so that the separated isotopes could be collected. Because of the intense time constraints, Groves could not afford to build pilot plants, facilities to test the scaling up of the laboratory processes.
Huge industrial facilities were commissioned and built without any significant evidence a deliverable bomb was possible. There always was doubt that nuclear fuel could be produced in sufficient quantities whilst maintaining a pure product.
Fission is more readily produced in a rare uranium isotope, uranium-235, that occurs naturally at a ratio of 1 to 139 to its less useful twin, uranium-238. Chemically identical, the isotopes were almost impossible to separate. A new man-made element, plutonium, was gaining favor as a possible fuel. Identified in 1941, plutonium was almost twice as likely to undergo fission as uranium-235, and could be produced on a large scale by irradiating uranium in nuclear reactors.
Though plutonium may exist in theory, it is likely that it can only be produced in trace quantities and not in sufficient quantity or purity to establish what its attributes are, nor in that which would be required for a bomb. The qualities of plutonium are highly convenient. Not only is it highly fissionable, but also castable and machinable. These qualities were improved by alloying plutonium with gallium, though other elements were tried. Gallium also supposedly lowers the susceptibility of plutonium to corrosion.
The isotope we produced was plutonium-238, produced by the Deuteron bombardment of uranium. Then a month later, joined by Emilio Segre, we identified in this room the isotope of importance, plutonium-239, and isolated it so that it could be have its fission properties measured at the 37-inch cyclotron.
Bullshit.
It's a real crisis. It's at that point that I think Oppenheimer's talent comes to the fore, where he brings in the people, new people, in fact, and he reorganizes Los Alamos.
Scientists and dignitaries awaited the detonation of the first atomic bomb in a desolate area of the New Mexico desert, known aptly as Jornada del Muerto, or Journey of Death. They had taken bets on how much power their creation might unleash, but many wondered whether the weapon would work at all.
But as the test date drew closer, there was a nagging uncertainty about whether the bomb would actually work at all. Lenses were created, explosive lenses that would focus the shock wave inward to compress the subcritical mass to critical. High explosives were mixed to form the cocoon the fissionable material would rest in. The molds for the lenses were the biggest problems. The molten explosive had to be cooled just right to prevent air bubbles, which would interfere with the detonation.
Inside the very center of the bomb was an initiator, surrounded by a sphere of plutonium. This sphere was encased within a set of symmetrically located, high explosive lenses, creating an implosion which forced the plutonium into itself.
But what if the real test was unsuccessful? The fissionable material might be lost from the detonation of the high explosive surrounding it. The decision was made early on to contain any misfire inside a huge steel vessel. It was 25 feet long, 12 feet in diameter, 14 inches thick, and weighed 214 tons. It was called Jumbo. By the time it was delivered, though, production of the fissionable material had increased, and there was greater confidence in the success of the bomb. Use of Jumbo was canceled. Instead, it was hung from a tower 800 yards from ground zero.
They canceled the use of Jumbo because at this point they had decided to fake it, and use of Jumbo would make the bomb be perceived as undeliverable.
Before assembly began, a receipt was signed for the plutonium. Value, at least several hundred million dollars. At the moment the receipt was signed, the test shifted to military control.
Despite the uncertainty and the doubts, the implosion device worked first time. With all the technical difficulty they admit to in making such a device, would you not expect a good few failures before you got it right? Of course, it worked first time, because they faked it. As with all subsequent nuclear tests, it was fake. The explosions were mostly created using large towers of hundreds of tons of TNT. A short time before the Trinity test, they detonated such a tower of 108 tons of TNT. The Trinity test was probably a larger such tower, of 1,018 tons of TNT. How big is this explosion? How big you perceive it to be depends very much on how far you think it is away and what you have to compare it to. The myth of the blinding light that supposedly makes nuclear bombs distinct from conventional ones is achieved using floodlighting, and possibly mirrors, and possibly through the burning of elements such as magnesium within the explosion itself. It is often illustrated to the public with shots of extreme shadowing, which can easily be created in a studio. Most witnesses will never actually see the supposed blinding light, as they were usually told to close and cover their eyes, and often to turn their backs. Often the illusion was reinforced with protective goggles and clothing. The footage is generally put together using footage of smaller explosions, without anything in shot to provide size comparison, mixed with footage of the sun, sunsets, and clouds filmed using time-lapse photography. There is little or no unedited footage provided to the public. Almost all of the footage has cuts, and often cuts away to shots of observers, or shots illustrating the supposed destructive force, and back again to the footage of the developing aftermath of the explosion, and then away again and back again. And so, the public rarely sees a so-called nuclear explosion complete in one continuous sequence. Mushroom clouds are not unique to so-called nuclear explosions. The illusion of nuclear weapons was also manufactured with the use of very large conventional bombs, fuel air bombs or thermobaric or vacuum bombs. Up close and from a distance, they could easily be mistaken for mythical, much larger so-called nuclear bombs.
You're about to witness the mother of all bombs. The massive Ordnance Air Blast Bomb, or MOAB, 10 tons of H6 explosive.
When they were testing it, people actually thought they were testing small-scale nuclear devices.
Plus, the psychological effect of the nuclear-style mushroom cloud is undeniable.
The footage of the mushroom cloud over Hiroshima appears to be two plumes of smoke filmed in such a way as to make it look like one larger plume of smoke.
H18. My God, what have we done?
The damage to Hiroshima and Nagasaki is not consistent with one single blast. The damage is uniform. Wooden structures have been burned away. More substantial buildings remain, with roofs and other flammable parts burned. It is remarkably similar to the damage caused by conventional firebombing. In Hamburg, Darmstadt, Kassel, and most notably Dresden, firebombing was used in such a way as to create an effect known as a firestorm, where a fire attains such intensity that it creates a central column of rising hot air, inducing strong inward winds, which supply oxygen to the fire, which significantly increases combustion. The better comparison to make is with Tokyo, where the construction of buildings was more comparable, and conventional firebombing led to a similar death toll, casualty figures, and damage. Japanese cities consisted mostly of wooden dwellings, and burned easily. Hiroshima and Nagasaki and Tokyo were destroyed by fire. This is not in dispute. It is claimed that in Hiroshima and Nagasaki that a singular atom bomb caused these fires. It is likely that Hiroshima and Nagasaki were firebombed in much the same way as Tokyo, and that the story of Little Boy and Fat Man is entirely fictional.
Here is the pictorial record of the result. At zero point, directly beneath the explosion, the soldier in the scene is pointing at the spot from which all damage to the surrounding area was measured in terms of distance from the center of the blast. Within a mile of zero point, the devastation speaks for itself. But in these very ruins, army cameramen have found and filmed pictorial evidence that tells in twisted steel and stone the effect of death-dealing atomic power. For example, this was the site of the main Japanese military headquarters. There were approximately 20,000 Japanese military personnel stationed here. They are among the missing. A lone concrete smokestack indicates where a bustling factory once stood. Reinforced concrete buildings seem to have withstood the explosion fairly well, the damage varying with their distance from zero point.
Three days later, another mission carrying the plutonium implosion weapon named Fat Man detonated over Nagasaki.
Cue the dramatic music.
Hopefully by now you're beginning to see this for what it is, pure
bullshit.
These skulls in the foreground are very illustrative. Throw in a nice emotive baby playing in the rubble. Burn victims are in no way evidence of nuclear detonation. Standard heat will cause burns. Burn victims are indicative of firebombing. Radiation is also not proof of nuclear detonation. Radiation can easily be faked. It merely needs to be claimed. But as we have seen from the TNT test at Los Alamos, radioactive material can be spread by conventional explosives, and so presumably conventional bombs. However, there is no significant evidence of any long-term radiological contamination of either Hiroshima or Nagasaki. After Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the American military proceeded to stretch the truth even further than they had before. Next came Operation Crossroads at Bikini Atoll. Crossroads consisted of two tests, the first codenamed Able, the second codenamed Baker. The supposed purpose of Crossroads was to test the effect of nukes on naval hardware, though many say it was a way of getting rid of surplus military ships left over from the war.
The bomb will not start a chain reaction in the water, converting it all to gas, and letting all the ships on all the oceans drop down to the bottom. It will not blow out the bottom of the sea and let all the water run down the hole. It will not destroy gravity. I am not an atomic playboy, as one of my critics labeled me, exploding these bombs to satisfy my personal whim.
By dismissing the absurd, you can camouflage the ridiculous as plausible. Able, supposedly dropped from a plane, was likely a large conventional bomb.
The bomb missed its intended target by nearly 800 yards.
Baker, a much bigger explosion, was probably large amounts of submerged explosives. Soon enough, the Soviets would begin to build their own fake nuclear bombs. August 29th, 1949, the Soviets faked their first atomic bomb. Making a device that will cause a nuclear explosion is one thing. Making deliverable nuclear bombs is a further challenge. Mass manufacturing these devices so that they can be stockpiled, ready for use as and when needed, brings with it further difficulty. It is not denied that nuclear weapons have a lifespan. This is good for the industry, as the need for periodical replacement generates ongoing revenue. The purpose of Sandstone, and later Greenhouse, was to incrementally double and double again the power of these fictional bombs. At first by using the nuclear fuel more efficiently, and then by adding elements, primarily isotopes of hydrogen, deuterium, and tritium. This would ultimately lead to the myth of the fusion bomb, many times bigger again. Also, during this period, they would invent a way of utilizing U-238 within the bombs. Before, they had wanted to maintain the idea that making nuclear bombs was very difficult due to the production method of plutonium and the separation method for U-235 being difficult, time-consuming, and producing very small quantities with very high production costs. The use of ordinary uranium-238 was required to make it conceivable for them to continue making bigger and bigger bombs requiring more and more fissionable material, and to make a large number of them. It was also very convenient, as large quantities of uranium-238 were left over from the process of isolating uranium-235. October 3rd, 1952. The British faked their first atom bomb. It was supposedly detonated inside the hull of a frigate, 8 feet 10 inches below the waterline. It was likely just a frigate filled with large quantities of explosives. Fusion bombs were most commonly referred to as hydrogen or H-bombs. This may be because they have nothing to do with fusion of hydrogen into helium, but simply that in order to fake bigger and bigger bombs, the igniting of large quantities of concentrated hydrogen was required, rather than the towers of TNT utilized in the earlier fake fission bomb tests. In 1953, the Soviets faked their first so-called hydrogen bomb. Making their fictional bombs progressively more powerful, they would also push the idea that at the same time these fictional bombs can be progressively shrunk. They have gone as far as convincing the public that they can be fitted into a suitcase, and that you can fit up to 10 of them on the end of an intercontinental ballistic missile.
Device ever detonated in atmospheric testing by the United States. Bravo was a hydrogen bomb using solid thermonuclear fuel, confirming the designs of Edward Teller and Stan Ulam, and paving the way to producing aircraft deliverable hydrogen bombs and more effective weapons.
Castle Bravo was supposedly a smaller device than IU-9, though more powerful, though the building it was housed in was of a similar size.
The Department of Defense used the series to accelerate military training in nuclear warfare while continuing its study of the effects from nuclear explosions.
Much of the nuclear testing was designed in such a way as to expose as many military personnel to the hoax as possible, so that they would perpetuate the myth by word of mouth, and so that as many people as possible would have an uncle or some other relative who was involved, and so would likely consider nuclear weapons a reality.
The 21st test, conducted during Operation Plumbbomb, was the Rainier event. This was the first fully contained underground nuclear weapon detonation conducted by the United States. The 3-kiloton device was detonated 790 feet below Rainier Mesa, vaporizing rock into a molten bubble 100 feet wide. This technology would have great importance after the Limited Test Ban Treaty, which would prohibit all but underground testing of nuclear weapons and hide future experiments from prying eyes.
Underground tests are very easily claimed. For many, no footage is produced at all, though it can be argued that underground you might better maintain a critical mass. It is likely that all underground tests are just as fake as those above ground. They've pretended to drop them from aircraft, shot one out of a cannon, hung them from balloons, exploded them underwater and underground. Why not blast a few into space on rockets?
Teak with a yield of 3.8 megatons, detonated nearly 50 miles above the surface of the Earth. The detonation created a violent magnetic disturbance in the atmosphere known as EMP, or electromagnetic pulse. This phenomenon silenced radio transmissions for nearly 8 hours and damaged electrical circuits from Hawaii to New Zealand.
A fleet consisting of 9 ships headed out for the South Atlantic. It is here that the Earth's magnetic field dips to its lowest point in what is known as the South Atlantic Anomaly. 3 X-17A missiles are launched from the deck of the USS Norton Sound. The missile's 1 kiloton warhead detonates at an altitude of 300 miles. As Christophilus had predicted, charged particles from the detonation travel along the lines of the Earth's magnetic field, temporarily creating a new belt of high-intensity radiation. For one of the most significant findings of Arbus is that the detonation of a nuclear device in the ionosphere could create selective blackouts of radio communications. By November of 1958, the United States, Great Britain, and the Soviet Union begin test ban negotiations in Geneva. With the exception of 3 French tests in the Sahara, the world is spared the rumble of atomic blasts for the next 34 months.
At Regan, deep in the Sahara, France goes forward with the detonation of her first atomic bomb, defying a United Nations resolution, the heated protests of Japan, and most of Africa's newly independent nations, and the disapproval of both America and the Soviet. Since the autumn of 1958, Britain, the United States, and Russia have voluntarily suspended nuclear tests, and for 15 months have been trying to reach agreement on a formula to ban all atomic weapons development. Now, France presses forward with this first in a series of firings to force her way into the exclusive nuclear club. This first blast is on a level with bombs exploded over Hiroshima and Nagasaki in World War II. The 250th nuclear weapon explosion in history carries France a step further towards General de Gaulle's dream of national glory restored.
Within 2 years, a dozen Atlas D missiles are deployed and operational. The first hardened squadron of Atlas launchers are turned over to the Strategic Air Command in August 1960. The missiles are deployed within blast-protected structures called coffin launchers. Even greater protection is afforded by the silo launcher, the new Titan ICBM. Is designed for silo launching. The Titan I is heavier, sturdier, and has greater lift capacity than the Atlas. An inherent deficiency, shared by both the US and Soviet ICBMs, is their use of non-storable liquid fuel. Liquid fuel missiles require hazardous and time-consuming fueling procedures prior to launch. The greatest disadvantage of these missiles is response time. With the early warning for ICBMs coming over the pole at 15 minutes, rapid response is critical. Solid fuel missiles, however, can be launched on command. Advances in solid fuel propulsion lead to the contract for the Minuteman, the world's first solid fuel ICBM. Starfish Prime, the first test in the Fishbowl series, lifts off from Johnston Island atop a 4 missile. Reaching an altitude over 5 times higher than Teak in 1958, the Starfish fireball enters the Van Allen belt, igniting a violent auroral display. The bomb's electromagnetic pulse effect is pronounced in Hawaii, causing blown fuses and radar blackouts throughout the Hawaiian Islands. A shower of highly charged radiation spreads rapidly into the regions of near space frequently traveled by Earth's artificial satellites.
The high-altitude nuclear tests appear just as fake as those faked at lower altitudes. Some appear to be achieved by dropping packets of powder onto a hard surface that explode on impact.
Following tightrope, the final atmospheric test by the United States, negotiations begin for the Test Ban Treaty of 1963.
In 1963, we entered the Limited Test Ban Treaty that prohibits any atmospheric testing.
Prohibitions of nuclear testing, moratoriums, talks, and treaties reinforce the supposed threat and allows the power structure to pose as rational peacemakers and allows for the demonization of those who supposedly don't adhere, and also helps prevent lesser countries from faking their own nuclear weapons. Negotiations may also provide an opportunity for nations to cooperate on how the nuclear hoax is implemented in an incremental, escalating, apparently tit-for-tat manner. For the USSR and the United States, there ceased to be any need for continuing to fake nuclear tests once the nuclear myth had been well established. However, they would both continue to fake nuclear tests and to expand their fictional nuclear arsenals in a contrived game of one-upmanship. Periodical bilateral talks would help to convince the world that each side was continuing to arm itself ever more and provide a plausible explanation for why it never led to nuclear war. Over the next 10 years, the Soviet ICBM force would grow to near 1,500 fictional nuclear-tipped missiles. By comparison, the US force rose to over 1,000 ICBMs, with over twice as many fictional warheads.
On October 1st, 1975, the Minuteman ICBM force was briefly shielded from a Soviet first strike by a missile defense known as Safeguard. Developed at a cost of over $20 billion, Safeguard was the United States' only deployment of an ABM system. Convinced that Safeguard's radar could be blinded in a nuclear attack, Congress votes to deactivate the site the very next day.
Money well spent. Beyond projecting power, profit is the primary driving force behind the nuclear weapons myth. It has acted as a protection racket, fleecing taxpayers for protection against a threat that does not exist, providing the industrial-military complex with never-ending blank checks for improvement and replacement and for decommissioning of an entirely fake deterrent.
By 1969, the superpowers were, between them, spending more than $50 million a day on nuclear armaments.
Through this film, we have seen some very poor, clearly fake footage of so-called nuclear weapons. However, America and Russia are not the worst culprits. Their fake nuclear weapons are relatively convincing in comparison to that of the Chinese. However, the prize for the most laudable footage goes to the British.
All the tests were airbursts. This meant that the bombs were exploded at 8,000 feet. At that height, there was thought to be little or no danger of contamination with radioactive fallout.
I think we had to turn our collars up. We were told to cover our eyes.
Exterminate! 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 Exterminate!
Some of us even used the berries and caps to cover them.
-30.
On the loudspeakers, we heard the run-up to the drop. The controller then did a countdown.
7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2.
And then at zero, we felt this almighty heat. Like somebody passing
a 5-bar electric fire very close to your back and then moving it away. It was so unexpected and so eerie in a way, because there's no sound whatsoever. There's just this brilliant flash. Although you have your sunglasses on and your hands covering your eyes, you could see all the bones in your head that bright showing through.
We didn't wait for the order to be given to turn round. We just turned round and we saw this fantastic orange-black flame mass just rising in the sky, and it was enormous. It was pure inferno. We'd seen others, but this was the biggest we'd seen.
It was almost beautiful. In fact, I think it would be described as being beautiful. And it rose very rapidly in the air. We were about 20 miles away, I think, and we got a really magnificent view of this thing. Unfortunately, the gurus forgot to admit or tell us about the blast. I think one was aware of a steadily enlarging ripple in the sky. This must have been something to do with the blast, but of course it didn't ever occur to us that this is what it was until afterwards.
On the 18th of May 1974, the Indians faked their first nuclear bomb. It was an underground test and could easily be achieved using large amounts of regular explosives. They claim to have conducted 5 more tests in 1998, 3 on the 11th of May, followed by another 2 days later on the 13th.
Only 17 days later, the Chari Mountains of Balochistan saw the predictable but tragic sequel to India's tests. As Pakistan set off its own nuclear devices, the mountain shook and turned white from the blast.
Inevitably, the public would begin to wonder why there never has been a nuclear war, and no cities destroyed by nuclear explosion as an act of terrorism, or as is more likely, a self-inflicted false flag attack.
Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev signed a far-reaching agreement. For the first time, an entire category of nuclear weapons was to be abolished. In front of the world's cameras, the Americans destroyed their cruise and Pershing missiles. The Soviets dismantled their SS-20s. In another milestone in reducing Cold War tension, inspection teams from both sides supervised the destruction.
December 1991, the Soviet Union came to an end. And in that year, the so-called Cold War between Moscow and Washington that began at the end of World War II underwent a historic transformation with the START Treaty. For the first time in history, the two superpowers agreed that year to significantly reduce nuclear weapons that could reach each other's soil. START, or the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, was signed on July 31, 1991. Under its terms, both nations agreed to each have no more than 6,000 deployed nuclear warheads and only 1,600 delivery vehicles.
Just as easily as they manufactured the hoax, they will dismantle it again. The Americans and the Russians have both in their START treaty agreed to destroy a third of their fictional nuclear arsenals. Will they one day proclaim themselves as heroes for ridding the planet of this mythical technological terror of their own creation? Will they replace the nuke myth with space-based weapons and, like gods, control the world with extreme weather and earthquakes, or at least pretend to? Or will one day the population of the world shed the illusion of fear which until now has controlled them?
Thank you.
our American way of life. Isn't it grand? Peace, freedom, and bacon and eggs. Seems perfect. But what if it's not? Friends, your future may not be as secure as you think. Where will you be when the atomic bombs fall? You can secure your family's future by reserving a spot in a state-of-the-art underground vault from Vault-Tec. That's right, Bob. Act now, and your family can wait out the horrors of nuclear devastation. And Doris, the vault will have all the amenities of your modern-day home, and it's attractive. And Sally, in the vault, you might meet that special someone, just as you would on the surface. And in a few short years, you and your fellow vault dwellers will repopulate our great country. And Billy, you'll have lots of swell kids to play with. Reserve your family spot in a state-of-the-art underground vault today. Sign up now and prepare for the future.
For your family, in the case of a nuclear...
Do not panic.